I don't wear shoes. And really, the only reason, when I started playing drums at 13, 14, and I was living at, obviously living at home with my parents and stuff, so we never wore shoes in the house. So I would just go downstairs and play drums without my shoes. I didn't think anything of it, you know? And then I had a gig. It's like, oh, I said, oh, great, I have a gig. So, you know, we get the drums and you go to play, and I had my shoes on because I needed my shoes to get to the gig. So I had my shoes on. It's like, oh, this doesn't feel right. Let's take my shoes off. And that was it. I never wore my shoes again.
You're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. Today's episode features the fantastic drummer Mike Isoudry, who is a busy performer and composer in Ottawa, Canada, playing with many projects in the funk, jazz, and improvised music scene. He's in the funk group Gefilte with a previous guest of the series, Josh So-Called Dahlgan, and in the Together Ensemble with his partner Megan Jerome. Today also marks the release of my bonus catch-up episode with Megan, in which she shares how she and Mike fell in love, as well as her new album, and great advice about an important aspect of the music business as an independent artist. Her episodes are linked in the description. This episode with Mike was unique in that he was sitting at his drum set during the entire episode, and we talked in detail about the history of the drum set and evolution of different styles of drumming. Mike demonstrated lots of intricate grooves and finished the episode with a cool little solo. He also shared stories from his childhood and talked about how in his youth he built his drums and an intricate treehouse in a park. This series is available as a video, a podcast, and the full transcript to this interview is also linked in the description.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. I'm so delighted to have such an amazing drummer to talk about the drum set. So I thought before we got into your career and your life, if we could talk about this amazing collection of instruments, if you want to play and talk about different styles.
Okay.
So a lot of people, well, maybe most people realize that rock drumming came out of jazz.
Sure,
and
yeah.
That the jazz kit evolved, I mean, drum set kit evolved out of jazz music, and actually swing was the dance form before bebop, which people might associate with jazz now. But the way the main pulse was kept changed over time, right, through that evolution, in terms of timekeeping, which instruments were used?
You know, it's hard to know what some of the older drummers played, because there were not great recordings of them. What did the drummers actually do before? Kenny Clarke was sort of the main proponent of bringing the ride cymbal beat into the main lexicon of jazz drumming in the, I guess, 1930s, somewhere around there. And he was like, what are you doing? Everybody was saying, what are you doing? That's ridiculous. Nobody plays like that. Now everybody plays like that. So it's hard to know what was there before. However, it's interesting going back further to how the drum set came to be. The very first genesis of that was the bass drum and the snare drum. That was the very beginning of a drum set. And that sort of happened in the late 1800s, before the turn of the century. And it was, and this still happens in New Orleans today. There were parade, like second line bands, funeral bands and stuff like that. So there's a snare drummer. And there's a bass drummer, so and they would play together, you know. So it'd be two people playing the drums, and sometimes there'd be lots of other auxiliary percussion as well, like cowbells and things like that, tambourines, lots of tambourines, and so it got to be that's the way it was, like at that time. And then when those groups started to play for entertainment in places, two drummers took up a lot of room, and it costs. It's two people that you're paying. So what happened is they came up with the idea: if we can make some kind of pedal to play the bass drum. So you have here. I can show you. So this enabled the snare drummer. The snare drummer ended up getting the gig because he had the most chops and skills on the snare drum. The bass drummer was, you know, it's not nothing, but it's not as much as the snare drummer. So something along these lines was made so that you could play the bass drum with your foot and then play the snare drum. Mm-hmm. And then that is the beginning of the drum set. Make sense?
And the research I was doing, it was interesting that the very first bands, they were actually, one guy was hitting, so he had to play the snare one-handed, and then he would reach down to a much larger bass drum before they invented the foot pedal.
Yeah. And I think...
So he's pretty hampered.
Yes, exactly. I think the first patent for a bass drum pedal was by Ludwig, fully in a full capacity. And then all the other stuff came along later. Cymbals were a later addition, and they were usually like early Duke Ellington or early Count Basie or Chick Webb, those people, they didn't have ride cymbals, but they had little Chinese cymbals as more effects type of thing. So they had done everything on the snare drum and the bass drum. Maybe they had a little thing, it was called a low boy. So, and it was like a hi-hat like this that you operated with your foot, but the cymbals were on the floor. So you didn't hit it with a stick. And then eventually it came up like this. So,
I was just, in terms of the hi-hat, I find it interesting because you were mentioning it, how many different ways it can be played. Maybe you can show some of those.
The hi-hat options. I really like the hi-hat, like, because you can play it like this. That's how you end up starting off playing the hi-hat, like that. And you can play it like this as well, with your foot. With your foot, you can also do these nice splashes. I don't think a lot of people, jazz people, do that. So, like, when I'm playing that swing rhythm like this, you can hear the two and the four like this. So, but other things I can do with that is, I'm pretty good with my left foot doing things with it. So what I generally, but I do like the hi-hat sound when it's closed. So you have this other little hi-hat here, and these sometimes will have a bigger one over here, but it's just two little closed cymbals. Okay, maybe you can see it on the big screen, but just like this. So I get more or less that sound of a closed hi-hat, but it also leaves this foot available to do other things. So if I'm playing a beat, say, it's not on the ride cymbal, which can be a little clangy. If I still want a nice tighter sound, I can use this extra hi-hat that I have and then use my left foot to do those types of things and then have a real conversation with all of those things. That's something that I like to do a lot with the hi-hat. Mm. And then
I was looking up the Zildjian. The Zildjian family, because I knew they made the cymbals, and I was curious about it. So I think it's considered the oldest continuously running company in the or one of the oldest in the world.
It is.
Because it's
Yeah.
As of this recording, it's 399 years old.
Oh, I thought it was even more older than that. I thought it was. Yeah. I thought it was over 400. I thought they had actually celebrated their 400th.
1623 is the.
Oh, is that right? Okay, well then I'm wrong.
They're probably about to celebrate it. Right, we're coming up to 2023.
That's so a long time.
It's interesting because
privately held, still yeah. privately held, family held.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when they came to the U.S., they moved the company from Turkey. I understand that they reached out to Gene Krupa to see, what do you want, you know?
Right.
And that he helped develop some of the symbols. But then I also heard that when Ringo Starr played on the Ed Sullivan Show with the Beatles, because people saw that logo, they saw the Zildjian.
Okay.
There was such a rush to order, they had to build another manufacturing plant.
Right, okay.
They couldn't make enough cymbals.
You know, and it was the same with, he used Ludwig drums, and it was the same thing with Ludwig yeah. drums. They had everybody wanted to play drums, and it's like, okay, well, let's get to work on these drums here. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think Ringo and a lot of rock drummers use two bass drums, is that right?
Not Ringo, he never did.
Not Ringo, okay.
Yeah, some of their early jazz drummers sort of experimented with that. I don't really know if it's a thing that was used well. It looks pretty great, you know, like it's a pretty wow, two bass drums. It's a pretty nice, incredible looking thing, like two bass drums. You know, personally, like I've never really for the type of music that I like to play, I've never really understood the need for two bass drums. There's a whole, you know, genre of speed metal drummers and thrash drummers, you know, and they use two bass drums, and they, you know, they play them very, very, very fast. Very fast. And that's that music. That's the way that goes. And that's not my music, but that is a total thing in there, and they've spent a lot of time getting that quick. I tried one time, for maybe a few months, like a long time ago, to do that. I had an idea for a jazz speed metal idea, but it kind of hinged on me being able to play speed metal, and I couldn't do it. I just couldn't get the bass drums that fast as I had in my mind. It's like, oh, that'll be really neat. Anyway, didn't happen. Still there in my mind, but anyways,
yeah,
maybe one day.
The tom-toms, they're tunable, right?
Yes, they are. Yeah.
So how many tom-toms do you usually use in your kit?
I use this floor, it's called a rack tom. They call it a rack tom, or a tenor tom sometimes they call it. And then on this is a floor tom. But that's two toms. This is kind of a minimum, second to last minimum. And then from here, like, I'm sure you've seen pictures, but there are like this drum kits with bajillions of tom toms, you know, lots of floor toms, like racks and racks and racks and racks and racks of tom toms. Very small ones to very large ones, you know, gong drums, you know.
It came from China, right?
The sonority of a tom-tom came from, yes, you're right. There were these little drums. They looked kind of like, almost like, a little like Kodo drums. And they were like, they were, you know, about this big sort of, and they had this kind of bowed out shell, and they had, it might have been a snake skin or something like that on the top. And they were tacked into the side. And again, those were more of a novelty type of thing that was added on to the snare and the bass, like the Chinese cymbals. You know, it's interesting that's a theme. But and then they evolved from there to more of what a snare drum, how a snare drum worked, and how a bass drum worked. Like with the tuning systems and stuff like that, I don't think that those Chinese or Japanese drums were tunable. I don't think they were. Mm-hmm. Whereas these ones the modern tom-toms are tunable. Going back for quite a ways now, but they have been tunable. So,
how often do you adjust the tension on them, or do you have to?
I adjust them. You know, it depends. It depends on the music that I'm playing. For example, when I play with Megan, I'll generally tune them lower. All the drums will be tuned lower. Just to get more of a, because it's not as that drum is, that's what I play in that isn't as busy or is not necessarily as detailed sometimes as some of the other drum other things that I play. Mm-hmm. So the lower tuning helps the sound of the band, helps support the whole thing. And if I'm playing something that's a bit more detailed where I'm doing more things, I'll have them tuned up a little higher so that will come out a little easier.
So a lot of people listening are listening to the podcast version and they're not seeing anything.
Okay.
And just the sound of the, if you could isolate the sound of those two tom-toms you have.
Okay.
And just do a little solo with those just so we can hear that beautiful sound.
Okay, well here's the floor tom. Here's the tenor tom.
Thank you. I'm curious about if you refer to your brushes as fly swatters and if you knew the history of that.
So these are the brushes here. This and they're retractable. Something like mm-hmm. this. So that you can, there's a few reasons for that. Like you can, so that they don't get wrecked. You pull them in like this. Mm-hmm. So they're a little safer than me. You can have them a little tighter like that, or you can have them a bit looser like that. Anyway. Mm-hmm. So fly swatters, yes, I guess you could say that. People refer to this as, okay, just beat the eggs on the snare drum.
I remember the first time I heard that sound live and it was just so magical. I just loved it. So I might be able to teach you something, Mike. They're called fly swatters because that's what they were originally developed as because it was before plastic. And drummers were looking for something quieter because the instruments they were playing with at that time were acoustic.
Okay, that's right. That's right. Yeah. That could make sense.
They were fly swatters.
Yeah. Bob Moses. And he used to play with branches. He used mm-hmm. to find branches outside of his gig and just play with branches. I like to use these things. These things, they're actually cajon. They call them cajon sticks. So they're a little softer, but they're also a little beefier too. And then I guess the last thing, the main thing that a lot of drummers will use is mallets, like this. So this gives you a bit, it's more of a classical type of thing. So you have orchestral type of possibility in playing. So you'll play that in ballads, mallets. I like to do that in, but also some other things too. Like if you're maybe a groove or something like. Lots of different possibilities that you can. Drums are very interesting in the sense that somebody asked me once. I have these students. He's a drummer, and he was an ensemble coach. And he says, I have this drummer, and he keeps saying, no, I don't have to learn any of that. I don't have to learn any harmony or melody. I don't have to learn any of that stuff. I'm a drummer. It's like, and then he says, what should I say to him? Because you know all that stuff. So what I said is this, is like, okay, you kind of owe it to all the people you play with, because every instrument, there's three things, right? So there's rhythm, there's harmony, and there's melody, right? You play violin, so you have melody for sure, and rhythm for sure. You know all those things, and you know the harmony. The ones that you play explicitly are melody and rhythm, for sure, right? Mm-hmm. Piano, you got it all, right? You have the rhythm, you have the melody, you have the harmony explicitly happening. Same with guitar. So if you're playing clarinet, for sure, it's a melody explicitly, rhythm explicitly. What about the drums? I only have one. There's only one. So you're only doing a third what everybody else is doing. You should know something. You should know a little more. Everybody else knows more than the drummer does, in a way. So it behooves you, for sure, to know that stuff. And it definitely helps you play in things. If you know, if you understand form and you understand a song length and you do understand melody and how harmony is working, you'll definitely understand drums better, and you'll be able to participate in the music better. So like if you listen to anything with drums in it, the drums could be just playing anything regardless of the music. If it's just you're playing in 4/4, but the drums should reflect what's happening, or certainly not get in the way. And the drums are supposed to support and help the music along. And you can't know that, or you can, but it's certainly helpful if you know the song and you know the harmony and how it all works and the form of the tune to do that. If you know that.
Jesse Stewart was a guest of the series earlier and last season, and he started as a jazz drummer but now does different things. Mm-hmm. But I asked him if jazz drummers need to know all the chord changes, and he said, well, you can get away with it, but you really want to. That's basically the same answer.
And you can tell. Yeah. I can tell when the drummer yeah. No, you don't know that tune.
I was wondering, Mike, when you've been teaching, do you find sometimes students, they get lost, or like the count, like if they're doing a 36 bar, they don't know which bar they're on, and do you have like tips for that?
Know the melody of the tune.
Okay.
Know the melody of the tune. You can count. And I'll be the first to admit I'm a terrible counter. I should have done this probably more as when I was coming up, just to do more counting.
Yeah.
I don't know, I just doing my own thing, experimenting and improvising and all that kind of stuff. So counting, I kind of know. And it's like, oh. But it would be, you don't have to. So you don't have to, but you should. I'm a better counter now. But if you know the melody, that takes care of it for you. Like in a jazz perspective, it's like, okay, well, you've got.
Yeah.
If you have a 32, 36 bar tune, say like all the things you are at the 36 bar tune. So there are sort of like four melodies that happen. So there's an 8-bar section, an 8-bar section, another 8-bar section, and then a 12-bar section. which is kind of like the first section. So if I know that melody, I'm not going to get lost in that tune. Even if I'm playing, I can actually start to go quite out on that playing because I know the melody. There's another one called Alone Together, and that's a tune. It's AABA or AABC, where the A's are 14 bars, and then the B section is 8, and the C section is 8. So 14 is an odd number in terms of feeling things. But if you know the melody, no problem. You know, it's interesting because you're talking about counting and everything. One thing different about the drums, say for example, and lots of other instruments, is that we're playing all the time. Is there ever like a 32 bar rest what I'm doing, or a 33 and a half bar rest? No. If I'm playing, I'm playing.
Yeah.
You would come by that many times, like 7 bars rest here. You play for 3 bars, and then there's 17 bars of rest, or something like that. It's like, yeah, you got to count all that. But if it was me, I'm playing through all of that stuff. Well, there's the violins. Okay, so yeah. they're there, and then you know, it's a different thing playing the drums in that regard. I just did a session this weekend for an album, and I'm playing all the time. The horn players will play the head, somebody will do a solo, and then they'll stop for a few minutes until they come back in again. But I'm playing all the time. So it's like, yeah, I don't have to count because, yeah, I'm playing all the time. You know, I like the notes are going by. It's a little different that way for drums.
Could we talk about Latin grooves?
What do you want to know about Latin grooves? I don't know. I would say I'm okay at Latin grooves, but there's a few common ones, like bossa novas are like a basic bossa nova is this. Very basic one, and then there are variations of that. If I'm playing a fast bossa nova, there's a lot of bass drum that happens in there, so I like to take some of those out. Mm-hmm. So, and this to this 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting there too. One of the other things, that's a more Brazilian type of groove. So there is a few different claves, and they're usually described as 3-2 claves or 2-3 claves. So a 3-2 son clave would be this 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. And the 3 and the 2 come from there's 3 notes in the first bar and 2 notes in the second bar. So it's like 1, 2, and 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, and 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3. Oh, sorry, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2. And that's there is a 2-3 song clave, which is just the opposite. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, and 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, and 3, 4. And then there is a rumba clave, which is there's a 2-3 rumba clave and a 3-2 rumba clave. So they're very similar. It's just the third note of the 3 is pushed again to the end of 4. So it is 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, and 3, 4, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, and 3, 4, 1, 2, 3. and then the other one. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, and 3, 4. And 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, and 3, 4. And 1. Like that. A lot of times, there's going to be a percussionist as well as there'll be drums and a percussionist. Now, admittedly, I don't play a lot of Latin music, a lot of straight-ahead Latin music. But I like to play some of those grooves sometimes. So what I end up doing, and I actually do find this quite helpful in playing those grooves, is I play the clave with my left foot. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. So what I'll do is I'll play a groove with that clave going, and I'll try and make it so that you can hear that maybe a little bit better as I go. That's the clave there, and then you can improvise around that clave. So I've been finding it easier to improvise around that clave by learning to play that clave there and play around with it.
So much amazing independence happening. It's so inspiring. I'm curious, when I've often heard like really great jazz drum solos, because you guys are keeping this groove, and I feel like it's almost to help all the other musicians keep track of where they are. But then often in the solo, I sometimes lose the one, like where, because it gets displaced. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yes. But you can lose yourself, too. It's easy to lose yourself sometimes. So you can start a cycle of things. It's like, I lost the one here somewhere. I sometimes that happens to me. And sometimes you have to be careful. Because if you're playing with a band and the band has stopped playing and you're soloing and then you want to do your stuff, but you have to make sure that everybody else knows where you are. If you're the saxophone player, you're trying to count through this drum solo that's happening. And you keep just doing all kinds of stuff, you know? Like, drummers can get really out there. And there's a lot that's available. And there's a lot that you can get lost on, for sure. Mm-hmm. If you start, like, you know, mixing meters. If you're playing in swing, say, like, in a triplet type of thing, you can start off playing some triplets or some swing eighth notes and stuff, but then, you know, you might switch into some 16th notes, like straight 16th notes into that pulse, and then mix them around, you know, mix around the triplets and the 16th notes, and then it can get really swimmy, as to where the time is. The drummer might know exactly where it is, but if it starts to get weird with everybody else, it's like, okay. If you start playing polyrhythmically, orchestrating polyrhythmically across certain things that imply a different pulse, if you get sidetracked by that pulse, then you're toast. you won't know where the one is, particularly if you're trying to follow along. So I prefer this. I generally prefer this. Is when somebody plays over my solo, So if I'm taking a drum solo, I prefer it if somebody is playing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought about just the other day why I like this. Because if you're a horn player, you get, and you're taking a solo, you get a chance to stop. You can stop, just take a bar. It's like, okay,
mm-hmm.
and then come back in, collect yourself and stuff like. If you're mm-hmm. playing a drum solo by yourself in the middle of a song, you stop for a bar. It's like, what happened? What the song is? Is it over? Is the song done? You just can't, yeah. you know. So if somebody is playing, see, just the bass player is playing a groove with me.
Yeah.
I'll ask him, please keep playing. So it affords me that possibility that I can stop as well. Plus, I get to play on the tune. I get to play on the song rather than just play drums. Do you know what I mean? Everybody else is playing.
I know.
Gets the luxury of playing. Oh, I get to play with everybody, and then I get to play with nobody. That's not fair. I want to play with somebody.
That's super interesting. Yeah. You mentioned polyrhythm, so I imagine you play 2-3 a lot and probably 3-4. Mm-hmm. Are there other cross rhythms that you
use a lot
habitually?
Polyrhythms. Well, I would not straight up in I will use groupings, for example. I'll use sort of like a 5-note grouping in 4-4, like in 16th notes or in triplets. So, meaning that if, like, my favorite one is to do, so it's like, there's 5 notes, so, and there's 2 of them, so that's 5, so that's right, left, right, right, bass, so then, and then I would do the other way, so starting with the left, so there's 2 5-note patterns. This is 4-4 and as 16th notes. Right? So it's a polyrhythm, but it's a grouping polyrhythm. Mm. So that's in 16th notes. So but I could do it in triplet 2, triplet 2, triplet. Nice different thing, and those are the types of things that I end up doing a lot. There's a 7 one that I is like but it's not quite a straight up polyrhythm. So that would have been like a 7-4 type of idea.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one was 5-3 or 5-4 type of polyrhythms. But 3-2, yeah, all the time.
Yeah.
And definitely different groupings and phrases. Like groups of, say you have if you have like a 4-bar phrase, so you have 16, assuming 4-4, so you have 16 beats, there's a number of ways that you can subdivide those beats. So you have a quite a long polyrhythm, so or grouping. So I would 3-3-3-3 and 2-2 at the end.
Mm-hmm.
to make the thing. So it's sort of polyrhythmic. It's a long polyrhythm in a way, because the three bars of four, you'd have four bars of three, or four groups of three in that longer phrase. A classic example of this would be sort of like a second line beat. And this would be more like a 16th note groupings in one bar. It'd be something like this. Put the eighth notes there. Or maybe the quarter notes. Mm-hmm. Make sense? Playing in four, but playing those groups of three in those fours. Mm-hmm. So that's how I do polyrhythms. There are people who do a lot of this. There's somebody I knew who has a book. His name is Peter Magadini, and he has a well-regarded book on polyrhythms. I don't know the book.
Hi, just a quick break from the episode. I'm an independent podcaster who does all the many jobs required to produce this series, and there are a lot of costs I bear as well. Please consider either buying me a virtual coffee as a tip, or becoming a monthly supporter starting at $3 Canadian, which is close to $2 US or 2 euros, and getting access to unique perks. The link is in the description. Now back to the episode. Now, you wrote a book, you wrote a drum manual, like a pedagogy book?
Well, it's a book of beats, basically. There's lots of beats in there, and then there are some other things in there, and some ideas about how you can make your own beats, and different counters and stuff that you can play in your own beats. It's a real good, I think it's good for getting some tools together. To play anything that you want to play, it builds your tools for improvisation in that context. I think that's what I think it's good for.
What motivated you to write it? Must have taken
time. Particularly for beginning drum students, I would have I'd be writing out basic drum beats. I'd be writing them out many times. I said, okay, well, maybe it'd be good if I had them. In a way that I can, okay, I've got a bunch of them, so I can just give them to them. I got thinking about, all these beats. And then there's this idea, and then there's this idea. So, okay, so it just sort of went in like that. So there isn't a lot of descriptions or anything. It's just lots of beats and different things that you can do with those beats. It can be for anyone. It can be for anyone, but one thing I do, I am definitely starting to realize now is the importance of as a classical violinist, what you've learned is repertoire. Mm-hmm. Right? Now for drums, it's a funny thing because what's the drum repertoire? What is that? What's the drum set repertoire? Like, how many songs could I probably zero that I could just, okay, I know the drums for that song. That would be probably zero that I would know. I could play many, 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 many tunes, But do I know any of them off by heart, like to play on the drums? The answer would be probably no. There's good sections that I know, like maybe Tom Sawyer by Rush, or what are some other ones that I might know? But not all of them, parts of them, not all of them. Mm-hmm. And that could be just me, the way that I've approached the drums in my life. I like to improvise, and I like to do those types of things. I can hear them. I can transcribe all those things too. But do I know them off by heart? I would have to say no. Almost none. I know bits of stuff. If I was to ask you how many tunes would you know off the top of that you memorized?
Not a lot.
Not a lot. Okay, fair enough.
Because I'm not a soloist, right?
Okay.
So for soloists, that's their priority. Okay. Yeah.
And so you're probably a phenomenal reader. You're probably a fantastic reader. I'm a terrible reader. I get so into my own things, and it's like, oh no, what was that thing that I just did? I want to do that again. I was like, oh no, that's bad. So it's not that I can't read. It's not my strong point, for sure.
I was thinking about that, because when you're doing all your demos, my default is to try to picture it, right?
Okay.
So I'm trying to write out the in my head, which is hard to do. But okay, that's just the way my brain operates, which is very restrictive. Another aspect of drum playing, which I find interesting, is the history of drummers being Foley artists. And like for radio, for silent movies, apparently, like when the talkies were developed, thousands and thousands of drummers were put out of work, because it was a big part of what they did was do all these sound effects.
Okay.
And you'd mentioned the Ludwig company earlier, and one thing I ran into with my research is they had all these different noisemakers for this purpose, and one of them was the nose blowing sound, like when someone has to blow their nose.
Okay. All right, okay, I don't know that one, but...
Certainly an orchestra.
Yeah.
Like my percussion colleagues often have to make, like, you know, sound effects. But have you run into that in your career, like in the studio, or?
No, not really. Not me. Okay. It's a thing for sure. And you're right. Percussionists do that a lot, because I think percussionists generally are dealing with really intangible types of sound. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like.
Yeah.
I don't know, like a chord on a piano sounds great. A beautiful note on the violin sounds great. I'm just hitting a piece of metal with a piece of wood. Like, really? How does that sound great? Like, how it's a really, but when they do sound good, it sounds really nice. I don't know why, you know, like drums, like is this an empirically nice sound? I don't know. Like it's a very intangible thing. What the appeal of drums is, it's, you certainly know that they're not there, but when they're wrong, boy, oh boy, do you ever know as well.
Yeah.
But back to the Foley. You're hearing a cymbal, and you're trying to find like all the different sounds that you can make from a cymbal. Mm-hmm. Or with a bow or something like that. There's different cymbal sounds that you can make, and out of toms and stuff. It sounds like whale music or something. So that's the type of Foley sound. So drummers are good at finding these sounds. They'll hit anything and they say, that's a good sound. I could use that for something.
Have you done hand percussion?
Hand percussion, not so much. That's a whole thing. It's a whole other... You start to sort of, the more you get into those things, it's like, you just do this. But it, when you dig into it more, it's like, there's a real thing to this. People ask me, can you play tambourine on this track? Just put some tambourine on the... I don't know. I mean, people who play tambourine well, it sounds great, and I'm not one of those people. It's hard. It's hard. And you think it's going to be really easy, but it isn't. It isn't. To make it sound really good. And I like to stay away from that because it's like, I feel like I'm sort of disrespecting that tradition by doing that. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And the listeners might be interested to know I'm going to be having a couple of different hand percussionists soon on the series, different styles.
Great.
Now, I noticed when you play, you don't wear shoes.
Yes.
For the pedals. You like the feeling.
Yes.
Is that common? Is that just one of your things?
I don't think it's... Yeah, no, I think a lot of people wear shoes. I don't wear shoes. Mm-hmm. The only reason... when I started playing drums at 13, 14, and I was living at home with my parents and stuff, so we never wore shoes in the house. So I would just go downstairs and play drums without my shoes. I didn't think anything of it, you know. And then I had a gig. It's like, great. I have a gig. So, you know, we get the drums and you go to play. And I had my shoes on because I needed my shoes to get to the gig. So I had my shoes on. It's like, this doesn't feel right. Let's take my shoes off. Mm-hmm. And that was it. I never wore my shoes again, like for a gig.
Were your parents
Were my parents supportive? Yes. You know, I mean, really, if you have a kid who's playing drums in your house all the time, that's supportive enough. That's fantastic, because that's a major thing. Drums are loud all the time and repetitive. The only time my mom said to me, I was practicing a lot. Elvin Jones does this thing like this. So I was doing that a lot. My mom said, just the one time, and it's the only time she was like, do you think you could do just something else? just for a little bit? It's like, okay, fair enough. But that was it. Otherwise, the fact that they would let me play when I wanted to play drums in the house, that's amazing. That's a lot of support. Because, you know, there'd be some parents would, you know, just, it's out of the question for you to play drums. Like, no, we don't want that kind of volume in the house. Or, and additionally, there's lots of situations where it just can't happen, like in row houses and things like that. And I've been lucky enough, and still lucky enough, to have a single house. So having earth between you and the other houses is a big deal. It really cuts down on the sound a lot. So I'm lucky.
I was wondering if you started with rock drumming as a kid.
Yep, for sure. AC/DC, mm-hmm. Yep. All the stuff would have been in the early 80s, so... mid-late 80s. But I was really into 60s music, even when I started playing, I started playing drums. So into Jimi Hendrix, I was into Pink Floyd, and I liked Rush and Led Zeppelin and those big bands. Mm-hmm. Yes, I liked as well. Yes, was I liked a lot of those bands, for sure. And I listened to them all the time. The first gigs I played were blues gigs, actually. Shuffles and stuff. More rock shuffles. Stuff like that. And that was fun. Those were really helpful in a jazz sense, because I am actually playing that triplet type of feel, and I'm also getting really used to hearing form as well. At that time, I wasn't studying piano or any of that stuff, but I was playing a lot of blues music, so it had a certain form to it, a certain pattern, four bars. Mm-hmm. Certain breaks would happen at certain times. It's like, okay, and I started to really get that into my ears. So all of that was really helpful in knowing where you are in a tune, in particularly in a blues thing at the time, and then later on in jazz, to hear progressions, 2-5-1s, cycle progressions, and hear those things as you're playing. Okay, and understand. Okay, here's one. That's the sound of the one chord. All right, here we are again. Here we are again, and this is the last two bars of the of this section. We'll go back to the top. So those were all really, really helpful things in feeling comfortable hearing chords, hearing harmony that way, knowing where the tonic chord is, the one and the five, particularly those types of things early on.
What do you think, like nowadays they have these electronic drum pads that people might get for their kids so that they don't really make any noise. What do you think about people starting on that sort of kit?
I always think that they're a substitute. I always think that it's a substitute for drums, really, in the end. It's like if I happen to, I hope it never happens, but a situation where I can't play drums in the house and I need something to practice and play, yes, I could deal with it. But at the same time, I do know what this feels like, an actual acoustic drum set, how it feels, how infinite it is and how dynamic it is. I can fill in the blanks, as it were, with an electronic kit if I'm playing it. And it would have to be a really, there's always a delay. There's a slight delay for when you hit the pad and when this electric sound comes back to you. Always, even the best ones, there's a delay. So that's the danger, because it's like if you're playing a violin and it sounds like a half a second later than you actually play it. How do you negotiate that? You might be able to do it now, but you certainly can't learn the violin that way. Do you know what I'm saying? So it's starting on them is difficult, I'd say. Having an acoustic drum set, because the other thing is that they're, you know, they're infinitely sensitive. I can't do this. I can't do this. I can't do this on electronic drums. Can't be done.
Yeah. You had talked about Second Line, and I know from my conversation with Megan that you guys have visited New Orleans a lot, and I know you've played a lot of that music. Yep. So that tradition of marching bands, also in different contexts in the American culture, we don't have that in Canada.
No.
You know, like, there aren't school marching bands, really.
No.
So I think a lot of kids might lose out on the chance to try drums.
Because of that. Yeah, like it's in New Orleans, definitely, for sure. But even when you go to any of those major universities in the U.S., there's a huge marching band. There is some kind of cheerleading band. You can get a scholarship to play snare drum, you know, in one of those bands. Seems unheard of, but you can. But New Orleans is a fantastic tradition. Have you ever been to New Orleans?
I have not.
Wow, something else. It's something else. It's not like any city I've ever been to. Like, there's just music all over the place. It's just so rich. It's so rich in music and heritage and food, and it's wild. It's great. I totally recommend it. If you only go to see one thing in New Orleans, go to a Second Line on Sunday. From about noon to four, go to that. It's fantastic. It's one of the. It's like, wow, you've never seen anything like that in North America, for sure. That to say, I had run a marching band for a while, and it was called the Mashed Potato Mashers, and this was sort of back in 2010 till 2012 or so. Mm-hmm. And it was inspired by that music, by that and other, and it, when I started just, you know, investigating this marching music and stuff, it's like, oh, there's traditions of this all over the world. In Eastern Europe, there's a really big Serbian brass bands, and there's a whole festival called the Guča Festival, and it's brass bands, and they play a certain style of brass band. It's incredible. It's amazing. So I took some of that. I took some klezmer type of music that I really enjoy the sound of that music, and also there's a bit of mobility in that as well. Some New Orleans stuff, but there's lots of mobility, and just a bunch of other things. And that was really fun. That was a really, really fun thing to do. And just finding out all kinds of, like in India, there's a big tradition of it as well. And you start to find there's all kinds of traditions of that. There's one in Mexico, it's banda music. And this was so interesting. And there was tubas in this music. I said, well, where did this come from? Where did tubas in Mexico come from? In the 1850s, really? Okay, all right. So apparently there was a German migration in the mid-1800s from Germany to Mexico, some large group. But they brought instruments. And they, you know, and then you know how that works. So like people come to different countries and they start exchanging their heritage and their cultures and stuff. So Germans would have a polka type of thing, and Mexico would have their own thing. And then they all come together, and then you got this thing that happened, you know? So that there's tubas and brass bands in Mexico with their own thing entirely. It's like, oh, wow, that's incredible how that happens.
Mm-hmm.
So... Yes, I love that music, and it always has a special place for me. I love every time I hear that type of marching music or Balkan music or klezmer music. I'm a closet clarinet player. I love to play the clarinet. Not that I'm very good at it, but those are the sounds that I really gravitate to, like klezmer types of clarinet. Those types of Eastern European sounds, odd times, things like that, and the way that they would play odd time music. To me, those are the odd times that are the most resonant, because they're real in the sense that they're based on dances. They're based on, it's not an academic type of thing. So when they're playing in 7 or they're playing in 11, it's real. There's a dance. There's a whole thing around it. It's got a name, and the song has a title, and it's about something that happened 1,000 years ago. And there's a very specific dance that happens to it, and it's in 11. That's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. Somebody I knew or know from who is from that region of the world came to Canada, and she had a hard time apparently playing in 4/4, because that's not the music that she knew. She knew odd time things. It's like, oh, no, it doesn't feel right. You know, it's too even, you know?
I was just curious, your parents were immigrants to this country, yes. And I was curious if either of their musical traditions was stuff you were aware of or heard growing up.
My dad played classical guitar. And that Spanish guitar, like he liked Segovia and John Williams and those people, Segovia in particular. And he would play, and he was pretty good. But there's a tonality of that type of music that is very Spanish influenced as well. And particularly the stuff that he likes to play. And my dad was from Morocco. French and Jewish, it's a big story, but the Yes, I would hear him play guitar, and I would see him play guitar as well, which I do also think is really important for kids to see people playing music. You can listen to all kinds of music on a stereo and stuff like that, but it is people playing it. So that's a really important thing, is to up close to see people playing music. Oh, this is the drums, the guitar, and stuff like that, and singing as well, guitar and singing. Oh, this is it. This is where it actually comes from. So I had, and then no, they would have to figure out, well, how does it get from there to the thing that I listen to in the box? You know, how does that happen? So my dad wasn't necessarily involved in any of the music stuff that I was doing. I would just hear him. I don't think he really liked me playing the drums, but anyway, I played the drums. So, but I'm, and he didn't really play a lot of this type of music in the house either, or any kind of Jewish music or any kind of North African music at all. But that's the music that I'm, or Jewish music for that matter. So, but I'm always gravitated to that music. Those are his roots. I never heard him play those things, but somehow that's the music I'm really gravitated towards. I don't know. I don't know how that works, but it's just, I've never been there, but it's somehow, mm-hmm. that is the music that I'm gravitated the most towards. Mm-hmm. So when I don't know how that,
I was curious. Yeah, when I asked about hand percussion, because of that music is a lot of hand percussion, mm-hmm. if you'd experimented with any of those.
No, not so much. You know, I hear them and then I try to adapt things to the drum set.
Oh, okay.
From those things. A lot of times, and particularly the more traditional musics of those regions, there isn't a drum set. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of hand percussion. So,
yeah.
If I'm trying to make something with those types of things, I'll say, there's a sound, there's a vibe, or there's something in here that I could put, that I could add in here as a sound.
Could you show a little bit of that? How you do that?
Like some people do, like... tabla sound. You can do it that you can translate onto the drums. There has this pesky metal rim, so you whack your fingers quite a bit. And I'm getting a little older now, so that kind of, oh, I can't really do this anymore. Yeah. but anyway, but yes, there's a wealth.
But you are using your hands.
Yes, for this demonstration only. But
yeah.
But yeah, there's tons that you can do, and then you can add the feet in. It sounds a lot like, it sounds a bit like frame drums. You can get that sound. Sometimes you can get a bit of a darbuka sound, you know. But definitely frame drums. There's a lot of that happens. Mm-hmm. There's a big tradition of that in North African music as well, like frame drums and Now it got me interested in that. I'm going to work on this a bit more. So I can come up with some ideas for some of the groups I'm working in. So it's cool.
I noticed on your YouTube channel you had a playlist of North African music that you like.
Okay. Yes, there's a particular instruments that I really really enjoy, like an Ngoni is one. I love that instrument. It's almost like a kora, but it's a little different, it's a little warmer than a kora. And neys as well. Like, and then there's in Morocco or Algeria, there are these large groups of people and have these big castanets, and they're like, but there's this rhythm that they play, and I still don't actually know what that rhythm is. It's sort of got an overall four pulse, but the subdivision of inside, I can't tell what it is. Is it fives? Or is it quintuplets? Or is it some kind of rhythm in septuplet or sextuplet? And then there's a singing that over top, and then a neigh, and this is really intoxicating. Kind of, what is that? What is that? It's so amazing. There's a whole continent of music there that is unknown, you know, in so many ways, and it's rich and deep, and it's really worth exploring for sure. For sure. I always find something amazing in any time I listen to that music, for sure.
I was curious, Mike, if you were willing to consider sharing your father's immigrant story, because it's pretty interesting.
Sure. My dad was born in Morocco, and he was Jewish, born in Morocco. In, I guess it would be 1937, Jewish, born in Morocco. He spoke Spanish as his mother tongue, and in the house, and Hebrew as their religion, and it was a French colony, so he would have gone to school in French, so he knew three languages early on. It was definitely exposed to those languages early on. And then this, and World War II, I mean, Morocco was almost bombed, or I think probably bombed a little bit by Germany in World War II, and he remembers that. He remembered that for sure. And then his dad died fairly young, and he had eight other brothers and sisters, and the mum. So they decided, okay, well, it's kind of too hard here, so let's go to France. We can move to France and live there. So they moved there, and he was about 16 at the time, and that was fine. And he was going to school then, and then the French government was. Algeria was a French, I guess, I don't know what you called them at the time, protectorate or colony or something. I guess it was still a French colony, and so there was an uprising in Algeria to be independent, and France was trying to quash that uprising, and so they were sending people to fight, and my dad was, you know, eligible to go and do that, but he said, I don't want to do that. That's not the man of our country. Like, he didn't want to go and fight for that, but he would have been conscripted. So he found a way to not go. Like, I think he was able to go through school, not have to go because he was in school. And then I think after that, He decided that, okay, well, I'm going to go to Israel. That's where that's my history, that's my religion, so I'm going to go there. So he was there for quite a while. And I think that's probably where he learned English. He learned English in Israel. That was the last language that he he learned. And that's where he met my mom, in the kibbutz, in Israel, in the what would it have been mid-60s. That was a thing to do. I guess it was a thing to do to go to a kibbutz. So there's many traditions like in my dad for sure. My mom is Danish from Denmark. My dad, he was always curious about, he delved into a lot into history later on. So he was always interested, okay, where's the Spanish from? Like, so I think at one point Spain kicked out a lot of Jews from Spain. And I guess a bunch of them, I guess they scattered, but a lot of them, a number of them went to Morocco because it was just across the strait. So and it just stuck. They just kept speaking Spanish in the house, and that was probably in the 1500s, I guess. So my dad fought in the War of 67 in Israel, and then they came to Canada, because my dad had at that point he had French and English, and he was an accountant. So it was like, you are, and they wanted to move. They were pregnant. They had my sister, who's 3 years older than me, and she. So they had her. So they decided we're staying together. A bit of fire and ice, but anyway, that's okay. So they decided that. My dad didn't want to move to Denmark, and I don't think my mom really wanted to move to another country in Europe. So they said, well, let's, my dad really wanted to go to New York, I guess, because maybe in those times, maybe didn't really know about Canada so much. So, but they suggest move to Canada. You'll have opportunity right away because you have this professional degree and you speak French and you speak English. You'll be fine in the federal government of Canada. You'll do great. So I guess they thought about it and said, okay, let's do this. Let's go to Canada. Let's go to this place in Canada. My dad didn't like the cold. I'm sure he didn't like the cold so much coming from Israel and Morocco. I'm sure he didn't appreciate the winter so much. My mom did. She liked them. Does still. But yeah. It is an interesting history, for sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you learn your skill in carpentry from him, or was there someone who taught you that?
Ooh, that's I don't really know. My dad did stuff for sure. I never did any of it with him. Like I was too young at the time, like when he was doing it. And by doing it, I mean just, you know, doing the basement of our houses and stuff like that. I was really into Lego as a kid. I would
okay,
make Lego and stuff, and like I would make my own things. I'd like make my own vans and rigs and houses and stuff, and like I would come up with all kinds of things, trains that had a little motorized Lego train. This was rare at the time. Lego was a little different. This was in the, I don't know, 80s, I guess, early 80s, 70s, early 80s. It was different. My mom is from Denmark, so she would go and get the real stuff, like from Denmark, from Legoland. So she would, I had all the interesting stuff. You could get it in North America at the time, but it was limited. So I had like space Lego from, and I had train sets, which never even came over here. Lego train sets. So I make these things and make little villages and towns and stuff, and with the train and stuff like that, you know. And my space Lego, I would make different things, where I would make a little sort of van with the thing, and or I'd make an 18-wheeler, a model 18-wheeler and stuff. So, and I would just make those things by myself. They weren't like models that they had instructions to make. I just made them myself. And you know what? When I was 14, I had always wanted a treehouse. I had always wanted a treehouse, but we never really had a tree to to make one in. So then we moved to this place, this townhouse one time, and then and out the back, it backed onto this NCC Creek, and there was this huge tree. It was just a big, it was just on the top of the crest of the valley going into the creek. This big tree, it must have been, I don't know, it must have been like 4 feet in diameter. This big maple tree. Just went straight up in one big trunk, and then it just opened up like a hand, like this, at about 25 feet above the ground. So it was like, and there were at some point somebody had put stairs up there, nailed in pieces of wood up the thing, but it was high, and I was like, "Oh, that's high." So I said, "All right, well, I'm gonna do it." So I went up there and I said, "I'm gonna make a treehouse right here," because it was really close to my house too, to where I was living. So I'm gonna make a treehouse here, and there was a lot of construction going around in the neighborhood. So you know, I sneak a piece of wood here and there and built this treehouse, or I built a platform first. So it's like, oh wow, this is amazing. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to build walls. It's like, oh, okay, I know how to build walls. You have a sole plate, or you have a piece here and a piece there and studs in between, and then you have some wall. Where I got that idea from, I don't know. I just assumed everybody knew that. So, all right, okay, this is what you do, and put the wall. And then I said, oh, I'm going to make a balcony right here. So I made a, this was the best part. It was so close to my house that I could have 3 50-foot extension cords and power tools in the treehouse. And it was great that, you know, my parents let me do it. So I had not big power tools, but it was an electric drill and a jigsaw. So I would haul them, tie them to a rope, grow up the tree, pull up the thing and pull up the extension cords and cut a hole in the wall, built my balcony, so then I built a balcony, and then I looked around, I'm going to build another balcony right there, so I built another one. And I had a roof with little skylights as well. So it's, and I was 14. So it just, I don't know, I have an ability to just to look at something, and I was, yeah, I know how to build that. I can build that. I can do that. And then I've since I started doing it, I've figured out other things like some basic wiring, plumbing, some of the more basic plumbing stuff. And I don't really know where I got it from, but there it is. And that's what I make. Mm-hmm. I make a fair bit of. I built my drums, for example, like these drums. I built them. I bought plywood and I.
Really?
Yeah. So
that's fascinating.
Maybe you didn't know that, but the like all the drums I play, except for my snare drums, but all the drums I play are drums that I've built. I built them about, I don't know, almost 25 years ago now. I built all these drums. So I don't know. It's one of those things that I just assumed that everybody knew how to do this stuff. It's just like, oh, well, it turns out that not as many people know how to do this stuff as I thought. Mm-hmm. Rob Frayne is a terrific musician in town, and he was doing some renovations on his house. And I actually learned quite a bit there. Like he said, mm-hmm. he probably recognized it in me that I said, oh, no, you know how to build stuff. You know how to build. You just look at something. It's like, okay, you do this, and this. So he would just, mm-hmm. So okay, go do this. Okay. So I would just do it. And it was great because I learned a lot. I learned a lot about, say, like hanging doors, you know, on door jams and putting in windows and things like that, putting up drywall, all those types of things. Yeah.
Hmm. You strike me as a very intuitive learner.
Yes.
Like with your music and other things.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Definitely. That's what makes me, I often think, should I teach more? And I'd have to admit that I didn't necessarily learn that way. I did take some weekly lessons and stuff, but they were really, and I did learn from them, but there are things that don't necessarily jive with how I like to learn and those types of weekly lessons. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, I learned a lot about drums and like building drums, and you know, I think maybe the first thing I did when I God, drums, as I took them apart. How are they put together? And I put them back together. Okay, that's how they work. So, you know, so
okay.
I'm that type of person. And, you know, not, a visual as well. So, all right, so how do, oh, all right, okay, well, how do you make round things? So, you know, and then I built my own tools to make them. And it's just a sort of thing that I just figured out how to do. And I do a lot of my learning that way, just figuring it out. And it was different. This would have been in the, I guess, late 90s, so there was no internet or anything like that. But I knew that you could bend wood. I knew that. Either by steaming it or just soaking it. So that's what I did. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Mom, for the bathtub. I just cut wood and filled the bathtub and soaked them in the bathtub for 8 hours, you know, and then, and then I made molds and got special clamps, and then for gluing I had special gluing jigs, like a whole convex jig and a concave jig that would go around the outside of the drum and glue pieces together like that. So there was, again, I thought nothing of it. I thought, oh yeah, this is easy, everybody can do this. But no, apparently. So this is what I do, and I make it is my living, basically.
Doing carpentry.
I wish it was music. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong. If there's anybody out there who wants to hire me, we just recorded an album with the Atlantis Jazz Ensemble this past weekend, and then Megan Jerome's release is coming up this Friday, and then I have another gig. I have another large group. It's an 8-piece band. It's called the Alouette Space Agency, and we have that's a really interesting band because there's two drummers in that band. This organ.
I was going to ask you about that.
Okay, this organ, clavinet, and Rhodes, and then two drummers, and then three saxophone players and a trombone player. So it's music that I'm writing for that. So that's really fun. It's really fun. The two drums is great. I think it's a really neat idea. And I'm trying to approach it as a way you can approach things in a different way, like the same tune in a different way. So I'm saying, okay, well, I'll approach it this way. You approach it this other way, and it'll be great. Like it's gonna end up. So, for example, like you just have to imagine. But if I'm playing a groove like this, I could, on top of that, I could do this. As long as we're both playing it in time, it's gonna sound this large, big fat groove of two different possible ways to do this. You could have like sticks and brushes, so like if you had that groove, so then, and then just that basic groove on top. So this, trying to get those two different ideas to have a really thick drum set texture happening. Rather than drums and percussion, two drummers. Mm-hmm. Different sounds, different sort of, I try to have, my kit is tuned a bit more, probably a bit more rock, a bit more staccato and shorter in sound, and I let Michelle have the more open sounding, maybe higher pitched sounding drums, and then I think it's working really nicely. Just having those two different approaches on the drum set to the music, I hear it crystal clear. Some people are like, what are you?
Yeah.
But anyway, I think it's great. Plus, everybody in the band is. I've hired everybody in the band, or got everybody in the band that has a real certain thing to what they do. Like Don, the organ player, his time is so good, and he's generally the person who is doing the bass function in the band, but his time is so good and his groove is so fantastic. It's like, oh, he's just perfect, perfect at that role. And Pierre has this real funky kind of clavinet thing going, perfect for this. And then the horn players, they're all my favorite horn players in Ottawa, and they just play in a certain way. But they all play different. Like so, trombone is, you know, trombone is the different one of the horns. But all the three saxophone players, they're all fantastic soloists, but they all sound different. They all have their own a really strong mm-hmm. individual voice. And then Zach plays alto, and Peter and John, they both play tenor and they both solo, but they sound completely different. So there's never like a competition, and they've all both gone their separate ways and have their different influences and stuff, and they're really deep into those. So they never sound the same. So like they can solo right next to each other and it'll sound completely different.
I heard a promotional track that you guys put out. It sounds really great. I was curious because you've been involved with a lot of bigger ensembles.
Right.
Which it must be fun as a drummer, but you also have a company, Propeller Dance Company, mm-hmm. for many years.
Yep.
Which must be a totally different gig. And then also you have a solo drum project coming up, right?
Well, maybe. Yeah, I Not experiment really. with that stuff before. There's a lot of sounds that you can create on the drums. Some electronic ones as well. Like if you have I have a certain way to mic the drums that I like to get a certain sound, and there's other things, and definitely many, many other types of resources that you can get on the drum set. So, but what I wanted to do was to make a maybe a suite of some kind, where the structure ends up driving the content is not necessarily obviously not note content or harmony content, but just structural content. Get into some song forms, you know, about, and build music on the drum set that way, as a solo instrument that way. I'd suggested like a rondo form or something where, you know, there'd be something that you go away and you come back and you go away and come back and go away and come back. Something like that. Yes, I was thinking about that, and I might think about that again. Generally what happens for me is as I get really busy in the summer with construction and decks and all that kind mm-hmm. of stuff. So there's almost, you know, there's the gigs that I play and I try and practice for the gigs that I do have. But then otherwise, like as far as writing and things like that go, a lot of that ends up falling by the wayside. But now it's mid-November now, so I'm still working, but there's an end coming. So I'll be taking the winter off from construction. So that's going to, and my piano is now dried out, so it gets really humid down here in the summer, so that my piano starts sticking and everything like that, so it ends up not being playable. But now it's playable again because it's dry again, and so I'm gonna get back into writing and stuff like, which I really enjoy doing. Because you sit down at the piano and it's like, okay, oh, this is a nice chord, oh, that's a nice chord. These two together, all right, and then that can ends up being a springboard for something. Maybe there's a third chord, and then it goes that way. And then, oh, but maybe there's this rhythm that I can vamp between these two chords. And then I might get that in my mind, and then I go to the drum set, it's like, I'm gonna keep those chords in mind, and then it's, oh, this rhythm, those chords. There's my nucleus of something, and then I start building out from that, you know, deconstructing and rebuilding and making tunes out of those types of things. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it depends on
in terms
what I'm writing for. If it's a large group or if it's a small, more of a small trio type of thing. So.
In terms of keeping in shape as a drummer, do you still do basic drills, or is the playing you do enough, like the gigs that you play?
I still do them.
You feel like...
Basic ones.
Yeah.
Just basic, really, really basic ones. And then also playing is important too, like listening and playing is really important too, because you have to keep your ears in. There's this, but you have to keep your ears in shape too. You definitely have to spend some, when you're learning, you definitely have to spend some time doing those things. But now I know those things. So it's a question of getting my ears and my hands working together. Sometimes if I haven't been playing in a while, there can be a disconnect there. And what's nice is that, you know, when you're in a nice practice mode, it's like the more you listen, the more you're going to get here by not even necessarily practicing, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a wonderful place to be at. Actually, we were talking about approximating hand percussion. That would be a sort of an example of something. So this is that's shakers, and this might be more like a right, so you can approximate a different thing, but it's drum set, right? So you can, there's so many different things that you can do on a drum set. It's a really, really, and I think still evolving instrument about and how people how people play it. One of the interesting things is there's a lot of machine beats, like beats that producers will make on drum machines, and and then drummers try and learn those. So I'm playing like eighth notes here, but they're behind. They're by a 16th, by a 16th note or something.
Yeah.
Rather than. Right? So that's more.
Yeah.
Machines would have come up with that. But it's like, that's got a certain, you know, certain thing to it. And then it's like, what do they sound like? It's like, oh, well, that's really interesting. And then you learn those rhythms, and then you go do something else with them. You know? It's kind of neat.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful, big world of sound color. You know, the drum set really reminds me of, like, primary colors. From these three colors, you can get all the colors.
That's right. But the... drums, if there's something wrong in the drums, everyone knows. Or if the vocal is wrong, it's like, oh, everybody knows. It's like, oh. The stuff in the middle, it ends up not being as offensive when those things go wrong, as drums do.
Well, on that note, I'd like to thank you so much for your time today and all the really cool demos.
Thanks for having me.
Did you want to finish off with a short solo just to put it all together, or? Awesome. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Great. Well, it was. Thanks for having me on the show.
I hope you enjoyed getting to know Mike Isudri and hopefully got some new insights into drumming. I have featured a couple of different drummers and percussionists in past episodes, and many jazz artists, and I continue to have in-depth conversations with a wide variety of musicians worldwide, playing in different styles and following different paths with inspiring and unique stories from their lives.